Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we've got food director Carla Lolly Music interviewing Tyler Malik. He is the founder and head ice cream maker at Salt and Straw, the now famous scoop shop that started in Portland, Oregon. Salt and Straw has grown into multiple locations across the West Coast since it opened 7 years ago. And there's good reason for it. Carla and Tyler talk about Tyler's very different approach to developing flavors and even try some new ones as they chat. And then they try some more, and then Carla talks a little bit and then eats even more ice cream. And after that, Test Kitchen Manager Brad Leone is on with Rodney Scott. Rodney's the chef and owner of Rodney Scott's Barbecue in Charleston, South Carolina. For those of you who haven't been on YouTube recently, Brad went down there a couple months back to check out Rodney's process for making barbecue. And we shot a pretty great video of the whole thing for Brad's hit series, It's Alive. The video is called Brad Makes Whole Hog Barbecue with Rodney Scott. And so Rodney was in New York a few weeks ago, and he stopped by the studio to catch up with Brad and talk about everything from the wood he uses at his shop to the hogs to the new menu items he's added. The whole deal. All right, let's do this thing. Here is Carla with Tyler Malik.
I'm so excited to be here with you, Tyler.
Me too.
The last time we were together was in Portland.
Yeah.
And we were doing like a quick little fun chat, live audience.
It's fireside. Yeah,
fireside chat.
With Oddfellows.
Exactly.
It was so, yeah.
And I just remember talking to you and feeling like, we need to continue this conversation. It was like a 15-minute event, but I knew that I wanted to talk to you more. Yeah, so I'm like,
I'm
yeah.
I'm so thrilled.
Yeah. I'm happy this is come around. And I guess there's some news which I didn't even really realize until I was kind of like reading up on what was going on with Salt and Straw. But a couple new locations, mm-hmm. right? So in addition to Portland, LA opened.
Yeah, and we're in San Francisco and Seattle and San Diego. And we're opening in Downtown Disney soon as well.
Downtown Disney.
Really mind blowing.
So Disney inside the park.
Right outside the park. Like
wow.
In between all of the yeah. So it's gonna be so cool, because I think like you just grow up and such a pivotal memory
totally.
For me growing up. So to be able to be a part of that in the kind of the fabric of the United States is cool.
Okay, I want to get back to that, because Florida as a location with some of the kind of seasonal or inspired or local flavors that you've done, like I really do want to talk about that with Florida, because it's not the place that comes to mind.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
are you talking about Disney, Florida?
In or California. See, I'm such a West Coast boy.
I'm like, because I always went to the one in Orlando.
And you know we're in Portland, Oregon, not Maine, right?
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
Oh, my God.
I'm just joking.
All right, you know what? Let's just back up. We need to just.
Okay, okay.
I think the reason why I'm so like scattered and kind of stunned is because there are 5 pints of ice cream open in front of me that are approaching kind of like ideal temperature of like a little bit soft around the edge, but still totally frozen, but a tiny bit of frost on that texture of the pint. So anyone who has paid $50 to have pints delivered to them on the East Coast is going to be upset, or in any part of the country, I guess, that I'm just sitting here in front of 5 unreleased flavors.
Oh my God, and they're so delicious.
Are they?
These are some of my favorites we've
so
ever
So unlike
made.
All the other salt and straw flavors, these ones are actually good.
Yeah. No, these ones are like mind-blowingly good.
Oh my God. Where to start? Okay, so you said coming in, like some of these are new chef collaborations, or
yeah.
I don't know if they're all chefs or just other.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. We're in 5 cities now.
I'm just gonna grab a spoon. Keep talking.
All
it's a compostable spoon as
yeah,
well. I would
as
I would
much
expect
as you want.
From
you could probably eat the spoon.
But I would expect nothing less from Portland, the land of where everything is composted.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the first time I ever saw a brown straw.
Yeah. You know,
in Portland.
It's illegal to serve anything not compostable items in
They're
Seattle.
They're about to ban straws here.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
your friend Danny Meyer is like behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
Okay. Okay.
I made 5 flavors here, and it's actually really cool because I think for us, we've done similar quote unquote series or menus like this in the past, but this one in particular, it was one of those things that we're in 5 cities now, which is just mind blowing. So we had this opportunity to kind of partner with 5 of our best friends, in each, or, you know, one in each city.
Cool.
And we went really deep with the flavors in how we created them. We spent about 6 months with each of these different chef corroborators.
Wow. And corroborators or collaborators?
Both, maybe.
Did they corroborate the final recipe?
Yeah, cool. Very much. Like, we were like, we're still even going back, like, what do we call it? Like, what's the perfect name for it?
So for people who don't know Salt and Straw, and for those people, I'm so sorry that you don't know about Salt and Straw, but you got to get in on the action. The flavors are... One, there's a lot of things that people talk about when they talk about Salt and Straw, but the kind of genesis story for the brand sort of started with this idea of making a bone marrow ice cream, right? Was that one of your like original inspirations? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. And it was...
people don't think, they think like, you know, Reese's peanut butter chopped up Reese's pieces and Oreos and, you know, ice cream being a sweet thing. But I think that one of the kind of defining things about your flavors is how far you push into a savory place. And so the one that I'm eating right now, which actually you could hear me eating, is duck cracklin with cherry preserves.
And it's, so it's a duck fat ice cream base.
Whoops, I dropped some on the
where
mic.
Basically most of the fat is composed of duck fat. We kind of built a structure in the base. And then it's really cool. We actually layer the flavors in there really, really nicely. This is with a partnership we did with Tracy Desjardins.
Oh, I love
her.
In
San Francisco.
Yeah.
And so I had learned so much from her just about like the different nuances and how we want the flavors to release as you get through one scoop of ice cream. So there's a lot of different things going on there. And every single bite is completely different when you taste through that pint.
Yeah, so that first bite, like you definitely get the duck fat, but in a very kind of refined way where it doesn't taste gamey or there's no kind of like meat to it. It's really just that sweet, delicious duck fat.
Yeah.
And then I'm crunching on something which I thought was maybe a duck skin just because it says duck cracklin. Now that it is, it's actually duck skin.
So yeah, it's really cool because like we worked with her. Basically, we took this technique. We couldn't feed the skin and use the fat and kind of whisked or, you know, emulsified that in with a little bit of eggs, a little bit of molasses and cream. And that's what makes that base. And it's both delicate and aggressive at the same time. Like there's this tension in the base of the ice cream. And then the skin, what was left over, we basically candy coated that, folded that in.
So
and
there
then,
is, it has a little caramel vibe to it. So it is actually, it's like, it's coated in a caramel or a burnt sugar.
Exactly. And it maintains like that crunch.
So it's like a croquant. Is that the French word? Is that what they are?
Is that right?
I don't know. Yeah. You should know.
I was a Chinese major in school, so this is a
and a good amount of salt too. I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. And then as you're digging in, I think there's this like huge hit of like farmy acidity from the there's a honey gastrique in there.
That
we're using
I haven't
a local
hit
honey
that. Yeah. Let me keep digging.
It's super funky, and then there should be this ribbon of just this really tart cherry jam.
I'm getting a little bit. Of that now. This is great. I haven't had lunch.
It evolves so quickly. And this is the perfect lunch ice cream, I suppose.
When you're working with a chef, and you've done dozens of flavors with chefs, or what would you ballpark
this is kind of the fifth year, sixth year that we've done this sort of a style. And for me, it's cool because we start from the very get-go, like stepping in and saying, like, doing just a massive brainstorming technique of and before that even we're doing, you know, a month's worth of research into what the different styles the chef works with, what foods.
So when you say styles, not styles of ice cream, but just their own personal, their culinary style, their style of their menu, their restaurant. So when I just picked up Tokyo PB&J.
Yeah, so this is with Gabe Rucker in Portland.
Okay, cool. And so, using this as an example. So a brainstorming session with him would be you guys get in a room.
The get-go is like we'll start and just like really hit the ground running and like what ingredients he's been working with, what kind of defines his restaurant, what are the verbs that he uses to define some of his, his cooking.
Is this sesame? Am I tasting
so
sesame?
So the Basie ice cream, this is a cool flavor. And honestly, this has like a lot of different inspirations going on. So the base of the ice cream is like a roasted rice custard. And then as you get through it, there's chunks of foyatine that are covered in peanut butter.
I love foyatine. But for people who don't know, what is that?
Oh, I almost like to think like foyatine's like like if you could take like a sugar cone batter, you know, from, and then like spread it really, really thin and toast that, you know, and get these like little almost like frosted flake shards. Yeah. It's so like rich and caramelly and
it's
really
a little
crunchy.
Bit like this is a bad comparison because it's much better than this, but the middle of a Kit Kat, like
yeah.
those sheets of
yeah.
kind of very thin wafery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the
but
like
more
the
toasted
uber French caramelized yeah. expensive version of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so yeah, it's cool because like his style has been evolving also because he's got this pastry chef Helen Jo who's just like insane and she's got like a lot of these more Japanese influence and so it's cool because he was working on an ice cream actually for a savory dish with where she was taking white rice and roasting it really really dark, steeping that in ice cream. And,
yum.
And he was serving that with and he was playing with a couple savory preparations for that when we were just starting this collaboration. And so we jumped off that and leaned into it. We added there's a ton of white soy sauce
yeah.
in there, which gives it almost a citrusy quality. And then as you dig in, you're not only going to get that peanut butter, but we also took strawberries, fresh strawberries, and basically poured a bottle of Japanese whiskey over them and roasted them until they start to caramelize really dark.
Cool.
So you get this almost like this really light, not too sweet of a jam kind of punching through.
I love the little, it's a little, is that the ground up feuilletine? There's like a texture kind of, I don't want to say gritty because that's not like a positive food word, but it is a little bit of texture in the,
yeah.
in the base.
There's the feuilletine and then there's the rice that mm-hmm. kind of like, so we steep it in and pull it out at the last minute. And so you get that really dark roastiness of the browned rice.
It's terrible. I hate it. Good. Just kidding.
As long as you're eating it.
So, no, it's quite amazing. And I would eat more, especially every time you say when you dig in. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to go further.
We can go.
But then I have like three more. So a case like that. Okay, so you sit down with Gabe Rucker and you're like, oh, I see you did this and your pastry chef did that. And maybe he's already had an ice cream on the menu. So mm-hmm. you're tasting that. And how much do you see it as like... and I'm really interested in this because from a recipe development standpoint, like it's a similar process, I think, for the recipes that we create at Bon Appetit,
yeah.
that you kind of have an idea and then it can be an on-page idea. It can be somebody else's idea. It can be inspired by something that's going on in the world. Like, the royals getting
yeah,
married
cool.
inspired us to do a cake also so that people could make
yeah.
a cake and watch the wedding. I think the most successful recipes like aren't just replicas.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're, yeah, are you trying to interpret like their vision of the ice cream or it's bringing, you know, how much of these they're made with five different chefs who have five different styles and menus, like what threads it together?
It's like, a journey. Like as we start, and going into the relationship, it's a complete journey on how we create this. So like, I would say what we start with is, 2 pages worth of research on what different ingredients they've got. And of course I've starred and circled, you know, 10 of them, these maybe combinations or plating styles
mm-hmm.
or, techniques that really like blow my mind. And sometimes I use that. And sometimes as soon as they start talking, I'm like, I'm just going to throw this all away. Cause you never know how inspired someone's feeling. I think the first thing we start with when we work with a really great chef like these five is that we have to like break that notion of we're not here to, I don't want to replicate
right.
even something that's on your, especially not something on your dessert menu and usually not something on your savory menu. I want to like figure out how can we like, when someone comes into Salt and Straw, how can we make sure that that person has a strong sense of what your food is and
right.
really gets to taste something that would be uniquely you? So between the spice profiles, the amount of even the acidity and salt levels, like how do we capture your taste buds and your
right.
voice and your all the way down to like how you talk and what the flavored names are going to be.
Amazing.
In one scoop of ice cream. And that's actually the hardest. So it takes the reason it takes 6 months to do this and it's constantly back and forth every week with the partner is that we'll start, honestly, I like to start wide and it's kind of like this shotgun approach of like, we sit down in a room and we talk about and brainstorm all these different techniques and ingredients that they use. And then we end up saying like, okay, let's just try this out. And let me make in my kitchen maybe 5 to 10 different ice creams that are mm-hmm. going to be drastically different. And none of them are going to be good, but at least I'll get your
feedback. Yeah.
Feedback. And like sometimes someone
will
taste something.
So those are in-person tastings, or are you like shipping pints back and forth?
Yeah.
Or
yes,
both?
A little bit of both. Yeah. Because we're literally doing it constantly. There should be a lot of red in there.
I'm seeing that.
Yeah, that's this.
I'm so sorry, everybody who's listening. I'm just going to keep eating so that Tyler can keep talking. But this is roasted beets, Humboldt Fog gelato, apple beet jam, and candied walnuts. Wow.
Yeah.
Beets have that ability, I think, to go savory and sweet. Like roasted, they can bring out so much of their sweetness, but
they're so earthy. Yeah.
And the color is insane. This is a very beautiful color.
This is with Brian Malarkey, and it's his style is just like mind blowing. And so with him, for example, you know,
super cheesy.
We had like this
in a good
like
way.
Good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that the density of the goat cheese, because it's a gelato, it just like it's buttery almost. And the jam itself, so we'll take like roasted apples and beets and roast them together with a little bit of champagne vinegar. And it just blows up. And so this one, for example, we made, you know, 10 different ones. One was even like this. It was a seaweed avocado sorbet that we made. We did, you know, obviously a couple different versions of beets. And we did kind of like a carrot duca. Like there was just this huge list of different quote unquote failures that ultimately you get in. And once he's tasting it, you get this like, oh, I love this. I love the spice profile of this one. But I really hated that there was, you know, so much salt in this one or this and that. And so we start wide and then slowly narrow in. And then as we narrow in, we're still like not even nailing it. But that's when we start nailing on like, or we start like finding, you know, oh, he really likes, you know, these textures in ice creams.
Right.
Or we want to aim for this combination of this contrast of flavors. And then we even narrow it down farther. Like, what is like, does he have a salty palate?
Right.
Does he have like a high acid palate?
Right.
And it's slowly like all the way down to finding the perfect ice cream.
So when you're doing this, just give us, I'm really curious, like it sounds like a Willy Wonka kind of factory.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious, like what your actual physical space, when you say you go, when you go to work, like where do you go?
Yeah. I mean, we have the coolest kit. We have two kitchens.
I have the coolest kitchen. No, my kitchen's super cool.
Okay. Well, you should come into mine.
Okay, you can come
back. We can compare and contrast. I have two kitchens, one in Portland and one in LA.
Okay, fine.
And I only have one. And they're like 10,000 square foot each. And so the one in Portland is where we do most of our R&D.
Okay. Whoever comes to this room next is going to be like, what happened in here? We've got a lot of ice cream on the... It's just a lot of ice cream on our little soundproof carpet thingies.
These look recyclable.
A jam pocket. It's the best kind of pocket.
This one was with Renee Erickson. Mm. We kind of like created our own kind of bastardized version of Ras El Hanout.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Moroccan spice blend.
Ras El Hanout with pickled rose petal jam. Wow, it's all over my hand. I don't even care.
It's like the jam is so bright. It's got this intensity to it. I think like she uses this spice blend a lot, like on lamb, things like that.
I love that.
We started playing with it and found it really, really nice in ice cream that kind of cuts through that creaminess, the fattiness of ice cream in a really cool way.
All right. We have to go back to your amazing kitchens. Which one do we want to go to?
Well,
they're both 10,000 square feet.
My Portland kitchen, we have a room for R&D and we've got about five people in there working full time on designing recipes. And that means that every recipe that we ever publish has usually gone through, you know, 10 fails.
Iterations.
Which is actually really cool because we're just constantly playing and testing out new techniques and new
ingredients.
And
when you're playing and testing, how many pints at a time or how big a batch of custard do you mess around with?
Yeah, we start literally in one pint at a time.
You do.
And I've got just a little tabletop machine.
What do you use? I'm curious. This was I asked our staff for questions. And one of the questions was, what do you recommend for like smaller batch?
I use two. My favorite one is called the Lalo. It's a tabletop with a compressor built in. And then I've got another one that's a Winter, and that and the Cuisinart are pretty similar built-in compressors. Those are fine. The Lalo is like a dream come true.
And is that like a residential unit?
Yeah, you can get it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not cheap.
Sure.
But they're awesome, and they last forever.
Cool.
And so that's my favorite. It creates like the
and
textures.
And that's a pint at a time. So it's churning and chilling in the same unit. Like you don't have to pop it in the freezer.
Exactly. And that way, especially if we're working with like warmer ingredients, the base can still be fresh made and warm and get loaded directly in. So it's kind of one of those cool things that you can't do, especially with the pre-frozen bowls that which are fine, but
every time you make a batch you have to re-chill. So is it a little bit like okay, in my mind I'm picturing there's you plus five people, so when you go in there is it kind of like what I would imagine the coder's room at Facebook is like? Everybody's got their own like thing going on and your headphones and your own process, and you're like
absolutely,
and you just like go to work and start playing around.
That's exactly it. And you go in, and so you know, when I'll go in there, spend a couple hours each day, and we go through tastings. We taste where everyone's moving forward on, what we need help with, what roadblocks we're hitting, and then we'll brainstorm, you know, what's the next steps.
And it sounds like, you can correct me, but that you also your custard base changes depending on what the other.
Yeah.
And you've also done sorbets, but just from the ice cream, is it always an egg based?
It depends. I like to think like I've got 8 kind of mainstay bases, quote unquote, that we try and play off, build off of. Because, you know, it's fascinating. So I'm just writing a cookbook right now.
You
so
are.
I'm like trying to explain this, which is actually really hard to explain. But I love this idea. When we're making ice cream, we try to start with maybe 8 different like foundation recipes.
Which is a lot. I mean, that's
a
wide.
Like, and stocks that... in a soup, you know, like you're not going to make a different chicken stock each time. It just makes it more complicated. So having a few different stock recipes gives us some room to build off of, and then we can be even more creative than we ever were because we have, you know, we know this is going to freeze up right and have the right
because there's so much
texture.
Science involved in how it homogenizes, how it churns, how icy fat, like how everything is working together. And so the bases will fluctuate. I'm imagining like more fat or less, or a different amount of sugar, depending on the sweetness of the other ingredients that you're bringing in.
Yeah, you got it like nailed. And sometimes, you know, we've got a couple coconut based versions
for vegans.
Yeah, and or if we want to lean towards that more coconut flavor profile or lean into it, like
very cool. So you do these, and I guess for every 10 fails face-to-face with a chef collaborator, there's probably 10 more that you don't even bring to the table? Or do you, are there
absolutely.
Things that you're just like, well, cool.
Yeah.
No. Time to get a different job. I'm going to come back tomorrow and start over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what's the most important thing for us. You know, our R&D team as a whole, we're constantly trying to push ourselves to find failures, and the more we can test out and mess up, the more we can learn, I think.
That's such a Danny Meyer thing. So so I want to talk about this. I guess it's more on the business side, but it's really interesting to me because you have in different ways kind of there are some Danny Meyer things in Salt and Straw that maybe go back to like having gone to their hospitality training and conference. And I used to work at Shake Shack. I was the first GM at Shake Shack. So on a very small scale, like we used to come up with custom like frozen custard flavors of the day.
Yeah.
And so, but the base, like I didn't have the ability to like change the base. It was, you know, the base was the base. Like we had not just a lot of, I didn't
machines.
Have a 10,000. We had a Taylor custard machine, but I didn't have a big R&D kitchen. We didn't even have a kitchen. So, but there are some, I read some things about that you read his book or, and did the training and have, when you onboard new people into the company, they're also kind of like going through some of that management training and style. So so what you said about having fails was something that when I worked there, people said a lot that the road to success is paved with mistakes well handled.
Yeah.
And just seeing those as that's like so cool. learning opportunities of, you know, sometimes you need to mess up to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, I think, and honestly, we'll use those, that fail, you know, like hopefully we failed 10 times and that's 10 jump, you know, kicking boards for new projects altogether. I think I arguably like, I like to think like one flavor we just completely just failed on hard. We made like the, oh, it's going to sound bad. It was like a crab roll Neapolitan ice cream.
Sounds really weird.
Mm-hmm. But
crab roll like a sandwich roll?
Yeah,
like,
we were going to put it in a sandwich. And it was for a feast, actually. I think.
Oh, wait.
It was going to be for a feast a couple of years ago.
Okay. So like a crab roll, like a fried clam bellies in a hot dog bun?
Well, it was going to be like a crab bisque. Oh. Well, you know, a Neapolitan. So yeah. Like a three-layered ice cream, and one layer is going to be crab bisque. And then it was going to be like a homemade Old Bay seasoned ice cream.
Amazing.
And a lemon sorbet.
But those are all of the things, like, in, I feel like that I've just tasted in all of these sort of, there's like the saltiness.
I've been avoiding shellfish for a while, though, ever since that.
But the, you know, having something salty.
Yeah.
Spice, like the Old Bay, and there's in
it
these
seems
flavors
like it would work,
here.
Right?
Yeah, it seems sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, it was not good.
But I did have your Choco Taco when I was in Portland. That was really cool because that had, did it have corn ice cream?
We made that one specialty for, it was a vegetable event.
Yeah.
So it was a,
right.
It was a garam masala cauliflower ice cream.
Right. Which sounds better than it, or is tastes better it than tastes, it sounds. It sounds terrible.
It was really delicious.
It was,
it was really good. Yeah. And then we had like, we took this really cool technique where we like, I worked with one of my friends. He grinds chocolate. He roasts and grinds chocolate. So instead of chocolate, we put freeze-dried corn in his chocolate machine.
Cool.
And he made like corn chocolate. And so that was the like shell, the chocolate shell.
Choco Taco. Funny.
Yeah.
And you guys also make your own cones as well.
Yeah.
So getting back to like some of the things that I think about with Danny Meyer and Union Square Hospitality Group and Shake Shack is the like culture of the line.
Yeah.
And creating a business where it's built in that people are signing up to wait. Like it's like they know at this point that there's going to be a wait. They're going to go anyway. And kind of that process of being on the line is part of the experience.
Yeah.
And I think, so I'm curious how you manage something as fun and kind of lighthearted as going out for ice cream with not only like these very forward and pushing the envelope in a good way flavors, but also taking the idea of just going out for ice cream and turning it into, you might wait online for an hour. And how do you manage that, the expectation with what you deliver?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for us, what we always dream of is we want that experience in the line to be the experience of Salt and Straw. Mm-hmm. And so when you start the line, that's when your experience starts.
Right.
We work really, really hard to find ways to interact with people throughout that entire process.
Right.
So what you'll see is, honestly, we have like someone starting when, as soon as you walk in, someone is meeting you and saying, here's the line, here's where you're, what's available to you. If you want to skip the line, you can grab a pint.
Got it.
Or right over here. Or
you could just stand outside and smell the delicious smell. That was
soak it in
and
your
Before I had ever been there, I remember walking by one year when I was at Feast and I was like, oh, I smelled it before I saw it, you know? And I feel like Shake Shack is kind of like that too, because you could actually smell like beef fat just flying through the park air. Some people didn't like that. They're like, I came to a park, not like a suet factory, but you know, you got to like and just get with it. And so I remember standing there and being like, wow, this line is incredible. These people look extremely happy, whatever they're waiting for. And then kind of walked a little bit further down the block and realized like, oh yeah, this is this place I've heard about. And the smell of the cone, that vanilla smell is so sensory and so nostalgic and also just like a really powerful. It's like when you go to the hotels in Vegas and they're sending out that like fragrant
which we
mist.
Don't do, but I always thought we should do more or something. We should figure out how to like pump it out. I think, yeah, and it begs for like, because we set up this space where people can feel safe and they can learn, you know, they feel like they're going on a journey or a staycation or they're, you know, learning about the food that's around them. It creates this environment where you're like putting down your phone and having this full face like conversation with the people behind you or in front of you. And it means every day someone is buying ice cream for the person behind them. We've had job offers offers and marriage proposals.
Amazing.
And like, you know, you name it, it's happened in these lines.
So the person who's coming out on the line is orienting you and like welcoming you and kind of like setting the tone. And then is anything else happening?
I mean, our team walks the line, and that's what, when you are greeted by your team member, I like to think of it like it's almost like a wine tasting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes our ice cream experience so different from anyone else. And it's what makes my job so fun and being able to create these unique flavors, is that someone comes in and they have this expectation to taste something they've never tasted before.
Right.
And our team has this expectation of like, I'm going to take you on a journey. And this could take anywhere from 1 minute to 1 hour, depending on how, you know, they're going to read their sign. And
so
say,
you'd like dole out like duck crackling candy while people are waiting.
Well,
like,
yeah, little scoops of the ice cream.
Oh, really?
Cream,
and, I was joking, but you actually do that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you'll get a sample of the ice cream, and you can sample, you know, ideally we sample all of them. We call it going around the world. And you get to learn about each of these foods, and you can spend like a long time learning about this. And we designed the space to be for that, for you to be able to like literally soak up this attention from our servers, and our servers love
it. Because it is a lot. It's a lot to absorb. So then also the benefit, I guess, from a management or just a operating standpoint, is that when people get up to the front, they have thought about what they're going to get.
And it's their time.
Got it.
And you have like this, you know, encapsulated like right. moment with someone. Yeah, I think it means that when you go in, you're going to see it. There's a lot of people back there. We staff it with
right.
about 20 people, whereas
right.
any other ice cream shop has three.
Two. Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
So it's a unique experience that we've designed.
And okay, so you have, I guess, also managing that potential disappointment of maybe the flavor you wanted isn't available, or how often do the collaborative flavors, how long do they last on
yeah.
the menu, and they're only in some stores and not others? And
yeah.
when, so that's one question I have, is like, how do you know where to roll them out and how long do they last for?
Yeah.
So answer that and then I'll ask my other
okay.
question.
Every 4 weeks we change the menu.
Wow.
And it's a hard start and a hard stop. Each city is completely different. Based off of what partners we're working with, which is cool, because I think it's ethereal, right?
Right.
It's just like ice cream melts, you know, our menu comes and goes, and we almost treat it like almost like a movie showing or like a, you know, monthly magazine.
Yep.
I love like Edible Portland or Edible Los Angeles, you know, like these
right.
These publications that are just here for a moment and
yeah.
just capturing this one season in your community, and it's going to be completely different in every single city.
So it's like kind of like a concert, like it's going to be in town.
Yeah.
And if you miss it, it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we treat everything all the way down to the, you know, hand-drawn chalkboard menus
mm-hmm.
are written like a concert marquee. And so it's
now playing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we love it. So of course, like you come in and it means that there's going to be, you know, maybe you're there for the last day of a menu or there for the first day of the next menu, and it's going to be very different from when it was. But overall, I think when you get this experience and when you build that like excitement
mm-hmm.
and that ever-changing menu, it creates this.
Yeah.
This
and a sense of urgency and a reason to go back and try something
yeah.
different. And then how often, or does it ever happen that a collaborative flavor is so successful, or maybe you just fall head over heels for it and
mm-hmm.
can't bear to have it say goodbye? Like when you have a roster of like the 10 classics that never change. So
yeah.
does it ever happen that a limited flavor gets to like graduate to be a lifer?
Oh, that's a good
Has
question.
Has that ever happened?
It's funny. We're working on one. One of the quote unquote fails from our partnership with Tracy Desjardins
yeah.
actually was like, when we made it, we tasted it with her and we're like, this is one of the best ice creams we've ever made.
No way.
But it doesn't quite fit with the rest of the menu. Can we use this other one and put this one in our classic menu? So
cool.
That's one
so
of the ones.
So it's like a Tracy Desjardins inspired
yeah.
permanent flavor.
Yeah. And
it
hasn't
it,
made it to the company. We haven't even announced it yet, but it's.
Well, you have now.
Well, there you go. so it's like this. Well, it's made with Mount Tam cheese from Cowgirl Creamery.
Awesome.
And then,
that cheese is so good. It's like a triple creme, right?
Yeah.
Sheepy? Goaty?
Pretty goaty.
Yeah.
And then we took like bread from Acme Bread. They're in the Ferry Building. Yeah. And we diced it up almost croutons and candy coated them. And so they're like these crunchy, like candied bits that are just like insane.
And have this crunch. But they're also sourdough, so they have like that funk and the sourness,
like this adds like this bounces off the goat cheese really nicely, or they kind of like marry together. And then there's a plum jam that cuts through it.
That's and that's in like a custard base
the cheese. So a plum and apricot jam.
Bananas. So no duck.
No bananas, but it's delicious. Or is that a saying?
That's bananas. Like Chunky Monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, just thinking about these ice cream flavors a little bit, like, I think people think of ice cream as sweet, right? Mm-hmm. Or sweet and maybe salty. Like maybe you're putting some salted peanuts on top, but it's a sweet experience. Or maybe there's like the Reese's cups or whatever, giving it a little bit of salt. But what you're describing is like all of the flavors that our palates are designed to pick up on. So the salt, sour, salty, bitter, umami,
right?
Like in that funkiness, getting into that, all of those flavors are kind of represented in one pint.
Yeah.
And it makes you want, whereas a sweet ice cream, you kind of like taste it, you taste it some more, and then it's like, I get it, and it's kind of, it's there.
Yeah.
But even the way that you're folding in the texture, so there's like, you're digging around, and that bite's going to taste totally different because I got more of the rose petal jam. And
yeah, I love to think about like the cadence of the way the flavors kind of come to you as you're eating the ice cream. And it's cool, like, it means that one scoop should evolve and it should taste completely different from when you start. And it's actually fascinating. I think a lot of our team is still falling in love with flavors that we came out with 5 years ago because they're finally tasting this one thing in it. We've had a goat cheese and black olive brittle ice cream that I remember I was talking to one of our team members. She's like, I finally get it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just blew my mind all of a sudden after 5 years.
Yeah, I wrote down just sort of browsing through some of the flavors that were on offer right now on the website through all the locations. So many, there were just so many savory flavors that I think are really interesting. Obviously the bone marrow we talked about and foie gras being another kind of legendary flavor. I think people love to talk about when they talk about salt and straw, but fish sauce, pork belly, pickle brine, fermented carrot, blue cheese, we had some of that, baked potato, olive oil, balsamic, and the black olive also was there, which, you know, if I'm someone at home who loves ice cream, doesn't have trips planned to Disneyland, San Francisco, San Diego, Seattle, Portland, LA, but your ice cream is being scooped here in NYC now.
Yeah.
At Daily Provisions.
I
read that. It's like
we've got pints
public
at the Meadow too.
Oh, at the Meadow.
Which
cool.
is, you know, Mark Bitterman's salt shop.
Yeah.
And then Untitled as well.
Oh, okay.
So we've got like a little bit of love out here.
And that was a little before you opened, and I don't want to start rumors or anything, but before you opened in LA, it sounded like also there was some ice creams became available like at Jones on 3rd or places where people would maybe start to talk about the ice cream.
Yeah, I think for us, I mean, we have these partnerships here in the city that we're just like in love with. And obviously being able to work with Danny Meyer, and when someone from his restaurant group calls and they're like, can we serve your ice cream? We'll do anything to make that work because we're like, it's family.
Totally.
And the same with Mark Bitterman. He was my first collaborator in my life, really, on our salted caramel ice cream.
Yeah.
It's made sense to work with them. Yeah.
So then people, I guess if you had to say the chances of would there be a salt and straw in New York City, for example, I'm asking selfishly now for myself.
One day we would love to, like, we our dream, it's our dream. At the same time, we're trying to figure out still, like, we're a West Coast.
Yeah.
I grew up in Seattle.
Right.
You know, like, it's this is still a long
way. So you
ways.
Can just zip. You can like zip. You can zip up and down the coast basically and visit all your stores and check in on all your people.
Which is nice. And now we have 450 team members.
That's amazing.
Which is mind-blowing. And so we're growing and we're seeing like, and it's cool because, you know, we started a partnership with Danny Meyer about a year and a half ago, and he's helped us figure out how to grow and continue while also like making sure that we foster like this, the care for our team members and the care for our culture that has been why we, you know, when we were just five people, or it was just Kim and I pushing a push cart in Portland.
I know that's another similarity to the Shake Shack, which also started as a hot dog cart.
Yeah.
And I used to walk by Madison Square Park, and I would just go because I was really interested in it from having a restaurant background. Like, what are these people waiting for? And like, it's just not a thing that you see that much in New York City. Like people, you know, it's they're far and few between. When people get online, they're making a decision to do that, and there's this payoff involved.
Right.
You know, so there's nothing worse than waiting a really long time and then being disappointed that you're out of, you know, salted caramel ribbons.
Right.
Like people would freak out.
Yeah.
Do you ever run out?
We never run out.
Never. And that's like a tenant of the company, I would imagine.
Yeah. And especially those classics. We work really, really hard around the clock in our kitchens.
Can't run out. Yeah. But you could have probably grown a lot faster than you have, but that's all, this is all intentional.
Yeah, I mean, we want to build that foundation, and we, you know, the past year we've spent a lot of time and energy. We've been building, you know, a manager training program and some of the internal stuff that you need to be able to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that we can't overextend ourselves without really fostering that internal side of the company.
Right. And so did you grow up loving ice cream, or is this really just a way of loving and expressing flavors?
That's a great question. I would say both for sure. And it's funny because like I myself included, we get a lot of people that come into the company or come into the shop and they say, I don't even like ice cream. You know, like this is not, but I love the stories behind this. I love, you know, some of these are so much more than just ice cream, and you get different textures and different flavors, and it's a journey through one spoonful. And I love that idea. I love being able to tell stories through a little spoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think ice cream is unlike anything else in this world, where there's nowhere else in the world where you can go and just try one spoonful of something. You can't go into like any restaurant and say, can I have this spoonful of that bone marrow dish? I'm not sure if I'm going to order it. I probably just want the salted caramel dish.
Right.
But you can do that in ice cream. And so it's so freeing from a cooking perspective, from a service perspective, to be able to take people on that journey.
Right. And then let them commit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they can choose vanilla, like, and we have the best vanilla in the world too, which is awesome.
I'm sure,
you know,
it's
like,
great.
And so people can, wherever you want to take it, you can go.
When you're not making ice cream and you go home after this day, like, you know, just putting a lot of steps on the pedometer in the 10,000 square foot kitchen, what do you make for yourself?
Oh, it's funny. So I'm getting married this fall.
Mazel.
So my fiance, she works at Bob's Red Mill. Do you
nice,
know?
Nice, of course.
So she
just talking about Bob's Red Mill earlier.
We're constantly competing to figure out who's better at cooking. She claims she's better, which I might agree here and there. Depends on what we're making and how much patience it requires.
Is there a lot of Bob's Red Mill in the pantry?
Yeah. So we've got like a lot of grains.
I bet.
And
Taff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You name it. We've got every grain
amaranth
in the world.
Everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think
so you're
we're
like
just constantly
nothing in the house to cook, like, kind of a dinner would be what?
I would say like wheat berries and a chicken leg or something like that. Mm. You know, like roasted together.
Nice.
A little bit of, I don't know.
Wheat berries and a chicken leg.
Yeah.
I love it.
Is
have you ever put, no, it sounds really good. Like, that's the kind of thing I would make too.
Yeah.
Do you put, and do you expect the same thing from your like home cooked meals as you do from one of your pints? Like, were you like, oh, it can't just be wheat berries and a chicken leg, like, but you know, we need pomegranate molasses and some walnuts and,
oh,
or are you just satisfied to have like, that's fine, I'm good?
That's a great question. I don't put much effort behind home cooking. Which is really embarrassing. Although I did feel better. I felt better. I was talking to one of my friends. It's like, I'm not going to say his name. I'm embarrassed now. But he was like, oh, I only eat, the tasty little microwaved goods from Trader Joe's.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's all. That's my life.
Amazing.
I was like, okay, cool. I feel a lot better now. He's like one of the best chefs in the country.
But I have a similar, like, after a day of tasting so many different things and eating, like, it is nice to just simplify, you know?
Yeah.
I guess people in, like, high fashion maybe look forward to just, like, putting on pajamas.
I hope so.
And, like, that's
how
their
I feel.
Happy clothes.
That's what
I mean, I eat dinner standing up at the kitchen counter, like, most of the night. So
yeah.
I really, no shame.
That's fair.
Okay. I don't know. It's kind of an unfair question, but I think people are probably curious about this. If you were just at the, you know, the Piggly Wiggly or the Ralph's or whatever, and you're
either of those.
Oh,
East
they're
Coast?
Just supermarket chains in
oh,
LA.
Okay.
You
I
can
know
go
Ralph's.
To Ralph's in
I know
LA.
Ralph's.
Okay, so you're at Ralph's and you're in the frozen food section.
Yeah,
you're standing in front of that ice cream section.
Mm-hmm.
What's your one?
Go-to?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That is a hard question.
I know. This is what faces the ordinary people every day.
My favorite ice cream growing up was, it's definitely the, I would say Häagen-Dazs Dulce de Leche.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever get that.
Totally.
It's like.
It was groundbreaking flavor when that came out.
Yeah.
It really changed like ice cream.
Yeah. I like to think our sea salt with caramel ribbons is very similar to that. Obviously, we pushed a
more
little
nuanced,
harder
yep.
on the burn level on the caramel and
totally.
The salt levels. But that was one of by far my favorite growing up.
Good answer.
I'd say I love cookies and cream. Yeah. I love like chocolate chip cookie dough. That's where you get the really cheap cookies and cream, and
yeah.
that's like game on. We've
Something
never
do that.
There's a couple flavors like that we've never actually done because. There's like no competing.
It's like too
really...
iconic or too nostalgic.
Yeah. Like you
would
can't...
cookies and cream be one? What's one that it has that power that you haven't done?
We've done like flips on cookies and cream. Like we're mm-hmm. doing like we do like a hazelnut milk based chocolate ice cream with, you know, hand or homemade Oreos.
Yeah.
So similar.
That's like
but
Nutella
like...
and Oreos
yeah.
coming together.
Yeah, but not cookies and cream.
Right.
Never, you know, we make a cookie dough, but we spike it with a ton of like brewer's malt and fudge, you know,
as
so it's
you
like,
should.
Yeah. So it's like, it's like similar, but completely like my own spin on it. So
awesome.
Yeah, I think the basic flavors I couldn't touch. Like there's too much
there.
You can't compete with like walking on the beach and eating a really, you know, cheap cookies and cream.
Right.
And that feeling when you're eight,
Toasted almond was my
oh yum
love a toasted almond
yeah
I could do this all day. We have ice cream melting.
Okay.
Such
we'll
a pleasure, and like I just can't wait to see what's next with you guys.
Thank you.
So thanks for coming
everything.
In. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, Rodney Scott, welcome to Bon Appetit.
Thank you. Glad
last
to be
time,
here.
Last time I saw you, we were down in Charleston where you hosted me, and we did that wonderful episode of Whole Hog Barbecue down at your shop for It's Alive. Fantastic, and thanks for joining us. What brings you up to the Big Apple?
The Big Apple Block Party.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, on Madison Avenue. We come just about every year to do that event with Danny Meyer.
Oh, very good. Cooking up some whole hog?
No whole hog. We're going to do ribs, St. Louis style ribs with coleslaw.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Great. And what, that's this whole weekend? Or
that's this entire weekend, Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 6.
Beautiful. Cool. Well, welcome. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you know, seems like you've come a long way in the barbecue journey, you know. So you started down in Hemingway, correct?
Hemingway, yes.
And that's
South Carolina.
And that's where you kind of cut your teeth and got into... To roasting whole hogs.
Definitely, yeah.
How long were you there?
I was in Hemingway all my life up until about 2016.
Oh, wow.
And decided to take the jump to Charleston and open up down there.
Open up shop.
Yeah.
Well, that's been going pretty well. It was a hell of a shop you set up.
Yeah, it's been huge.
Yeah. So, yeah, but let me just try to paint the picture real quick. So, you know, you got the storefront. If for anyone who hasn't seen the video where Rodney showed me his whole operation. So you got your storefront, the restaurant in the front of the house, just like, you know, casual.
Yeah.
And then in the back, you know, I'll never forget. It's just like it's kind of burned into my mind. It's like this dark, hazy, smoke-filled room with this inferno burning in the background. And then there's like these big steel boxes that you can, you know, the tops rise with these, you know, heavy-duty bike chains. And it was a pretty impressive operation.
Thank you.
Yeah. So it was. So you, right off the bat, you know, let's talk fuel. So you're roasting these whole hogs, and I know you do some chickens and stuff like that. You use wood, correct?
Yes, we do all wood.
All wood.
Yes.
And why?
Well, that's what I grew up doing. You know, all we used was wood. It was cheaper than going out buying charcoal. So, and it tastes better when we did it with the wood.
Right.
And we just stuck with the wood. We went and cut it ourselves, kept it piled up on the yard every week. Plus, we live out in the rural areas where trees are everywhere.
Right. Yeah, it's a resource that's there. Why not?
Yeah, it's like a local resource you could just go just about grab anywhere.
Right. And what kind of woods you guys like using?
I like using oak and hickory.
Oak and hickory. Oh,
yeah.
And what, so that just gives off a nice flavor?
Nice flavor. The hickory gives a nice flavor to it, the oak as well. And I like both mixed together.
Nice. And they're both hardwoods.
But all hardwoods,
so
yes.
You want to burn hardwoods.
You definitely want to burn hardwoods.
Like, you wouldn't want to burn what, say?
Pine.
Right.
You burn pine, you're going to get a nasty, bitter flavor.
Just like, yeah, because it's got so much like that resin in it. Yeah. It's just like you go touch a pine tree, you get that sap, it sticks to your finger.
You don't want that.
You don't want that in your smoke, which is just going to stick to your food, essentially,
ooh,
right?
Ooh, nasty.
No good.
Nasty.
Cool. All right, so that's the wood. And then your rigs, you know, we're back in that room. You know, it's dark, but there's a lot of open windows. So, you know, you see customers walking by, they're saying hi.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's fresh air, but it's also like this, you just got to watch the video because it's quite the spectacle.
They got to check out the video.
And then you've got these big boxes. Well, they look like they're pretty custom-made rigs there.
Yeah, they're all custom-made. We just sat with architect and welder, and we put our heads together and say, what's the most efficient way to cook hogs with these metal boxes where we put the lids? And that's where the bicycle chain idea came in, to put them on counterweights to where we lift the lids and they stay up.
Right. Well, that's smart.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go holding that big heavy lid.
No, you can't hold it.
Because what, it's all steel?
It's all steel.
Yeah.
And it vents out through the roof, so the smoke goes straight out. And then when you open it, it's like a makeshift hood until you're finished loading a pit or unloading it.
Right. And so, and then the heat source, so it's like, you got this box, and then underneath it you have is like your coal chamber, right?
Yeah.
They're not in direct contact with the coals.
They're not in direct contact, but there's a wide open gap. It's not an offset design.
Gotcha.
That's why we use just the hot coals off the wood and not the wood itself, so that we have the heat and a little bit of flavor that's left in the wood going directly into our meat.
Gotcha. Right. So, like I said, there's that like inferno, as I described it. And that was like your burn barrel chamber.
Yeah.
And what? So you were burning down the wood there. Why don't you want to just go throwing logs under the pig?
If you throw the log in, you're going to get that real bitter smoke burning off the log itself. It'll look bluish,
right,
kind of hard. And then once it burns down the coals, it's more subtle. It's a cleaner smoke. It's like more of a white color to it.
Gotcha. Right, so you get a better flavor,
yeah,
a little bit more of a less aggressive cook too.
Because
well, barbecue at the end of the day, this is a low and slow.
Low and
right?
slow. Yeah.
I mean, that's the process we're going at, and I mean, it's nothing. I was only there for a day with you guys, you know, did 2 days or something, and you know, it's hard work, man. And you know, I was back in that room with you guys, and you know, in the front of the house, and you know, I just wanted to ask you, you know, once I left, you know, my little, you know, weekend warrior came down and barbecued with you. You know, what's kind of like a week in the life of Rodney and the crew, because it's not just you. I mean, you can't be doing this all by yourself.
Got a great staff.
Yeah.
I got other pit masters in there that stand by me, and they know it's hot. They know it's intense, but they love it as well, and they stick in there.
Yeah.
So the day in the life is you start around 4:30, 5 a.m. You got to be out there with your fire burning, getting the hogs ready for the day, you know, pulling out all the sides, getting the ovens going for the sides. It's an intense day,
right?
You know, just doing getting the meats itself ready, that's a lot of work versus just going into the kitchen and starting with the collards and the mac and cheese and the cornbread.
Right. We'll get to those.
Yeah. Oh, man. All that stuff has to kick in as well.
Sure. So, yes, I mean, you guys, is someone there pretty much like all the time?
Pretty much all the time.
And, you know, so you guys are open, you're cranking out barbecue 7 days a week, it sounds
seven
like.
7 days a week.
Well, not too bad. Hey, good for the people of Charleston.
People get hungry 7 days a week, That's so right. Why not cook 7 days a week?
Absolutely. So, yeah, you were saying you got your whole hogs, and that's what we did down there. I got to see you had some chickens on there, too. What other other stuff that you fool around with the barbecue?
Of course, the ribs, and everybody knows about the ribs. But the one thing that we were surprised with is our steak sandwich.
Oh, that's right.
We do the steak sandwich. We marinate the ribeye loin and rub it, smoke it, chill it down, slice it, and finish it on the flat top with onions, lettuce, ooh, tomato, mayo, and cheese.
That sounds terrible.
Man, that sandwich is amazing.
That sounds real good.
It's like a southern cheese steak.
Now, I like that you said you smoke them whole, yes, like a whole ribeye.
Smoke the whole ribeye.
And then you slice them, and then flash them up on the flat top?
Flash them on the flat top.
And, oh, yeah, that sounds perfect.
It's amazing.
So you get a nice little caramelization on there. Yes. Everything's nice and smoky and tender.
It is so good.
Well, I'm starving now.
It is so good.
That sounds good. So we got pork. I saw some chickens that you did on there.
Yes, we do chickens.
You ever get a little wild there? Throw like a goat on there or something?
No,
or?
we hadn't done a goat in there yet,
or but lamb?
I have done lamb.
Okay,
before.
How'd that come out?
Great.
Yeah.
Great, man. We did it several different ways. You know, we did it with herbs and olive oil, and also we did it with just natural pork fat on the top while it was smoking.
Oh, wow.
It was great.
Yeah, it couldn't have been too bad, huh?
Yeah, we played around with a little brisket, but, I wasn't satisfied with that.
Yeah.
I left that alone.
Well, yeah, there's always room to learn, right? Is there any thing that you're excited that you, under this, top secret things you want to share in the works there? People,
I wouldn't say top secret, but I'll definitely say that we do plan to expand the menu a little bit more. Well, we did. We added turkey since you've been there.
Oh, turkey, yeah.
Yeah, we've added smoked turkey. We've added some wings.
Oh, awesome.
We've added a salad for those that, don't want to eat too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So we made some advancements, and we also announced that we're going to open up in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, spread the love.
I'm sure they'll love you. I heard you say wings. Some of the best wings I ever had were, smoked wings.
Yeah. Yes, and you can't beat it.
It's unbelievable. I had duck wings that were smoked, and they were, so they were a little bigger, a little meatier.
Yeah.
But you're doing chicken wings, huh?
Chicken wings,
yeah. You said you do turkey. You guys doing breasts or bird?
We're doing breasts.
Maybe get some turkey wings in there, smoked turkey wings. Yeah. Huh?
Don't push my envelope. I will.
That sounds good. Cool. So we were talking before, you mentioned, it takes a whole team, and you got the pig, you got your chickens, you got your rib, all the stuff in prep. And then you mentioned, some of the sides.
Yeah.
What are some of the sides you can get down at that fine establishment?
Some of the sides that we have is the mac and cheese, collard greens. We have cornbread.
All right.
We have fresh cut fries, hush puppies. We have banana pudding for dessert.
All right.
We even have pork skins in the bag if you want to snack on them or add them to your little meal while you're there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so those basic sides for right now.
Now, are those sides, a lot of them are kind of classic barbecue sides. When you were back in Hemingway and, growing up, are some of those sides kind of nostalgic for you?
The baked beans is the very one that's real nostalgic because my mom used to cook the beans every Wednesday night with some rice, just the beans and the rice.
All right.
And
big old pot of them? Or?
Dude, that was looking...
That was it, huh?
That was it. That was my night, And if you put meat in it or didn't, it was still a great meal.
Yeah,
those beans will fill you up.
Yeah, good rice and beans.
You can't beat it.
You can't really beat that.
Can't beat it.
So so the size, yeah. So all of those, is any of those tied to, other than the beans, is that anything just tied to that region, or is it kind of like just more of a broad kind of barbecue? Like, is that like a East Coast Southern kind of barbecue sides, or is that just broad?
Well, kind of yes and no. The mac and cheese recipe that we have is a little different than what I grew up with, because the one we grew up with involved a lot of work, just adding milk and cheeses and all that. But the one that we have now is a lot more simpler, but it still is tasty.
Yeah, a little less is more sometimes.
Yeah, less is more. And, you know, when you're feeding the masses, you know, you can't put everything in it all the time.
Right.
You know, from a business standpoint.
Yeah, right.
But it's still great. It's still one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And everything else is pretty much how I grew up, with a touch of abroad.
Right.
Like, I never liked collards, but I serve them.
Right.
Right.
People do, though.
Right. Yeah. You know, the collards are unique, mm-hmm. a little different than what my mom did, but they smell great. I did taste them twice. Gotta admit.
So there's some childhood trauma.
Yeah, right? There's a little bit of trauma in there, you know. The banana pudding is just the way I grew up. The hush puppies are pretty much what I like, the flavor that I like.
Right.
The baked beans, again, home.
Right.
Just like home. So everything is kind of like classic with me growing up, with a touch of evolution, if you will.
Yeah. You know. So what, you got into cooking when you were, I'm assuming, younger.
Way younger.
Right. Yeah. So was your family into it?
My family was into, they had a variety store, and barbecue was cooked on the side to sell sandwiches.
In Hemingway, small town?
Small town, okay. Hemingway, town of about 400 people.
Okay, cool.
And, you know, we did it on Thursdays only. And it got so popular, it just elevated into 3-4 days a week.
Oh, so it was just like a little side project of the main variety store.
Yeah. You know how you stop at a gas station, you find a hot dog.
Right. Someone's smoking chicken in the back or something, right?
Yeah. You stopped by our place and we had a barbecue sandwich.
Cool.
And it just evolved.
And it just, oh, so you started on one day and then it just became more popular and popular. Before you know it, there's a line.
And demand came and we just started
cooking.
Did it
overtake the variety store?
It took it all the way up.
Oh, wow. No more variety, just barbecue.
Yeah, it's just barbecue now, yeah.
All right, nothing wrong with that. So, yeah, so you were there for a while and then you said around, what, 2016?
Is
when you made the jump.
I made the jump.
So you were out in Hemingway the whole time. I'm assuming your rig, your setup was much different than those custom boxes that you got now.
Hemingway was totally different. Okay. Hemingway was cinder block pits.
Yeah, I've never been. I wish it would have been cool to check out. So paint us the picture.
It's well, we had a fire, so we rebuilt, and upon rebuilding, we put the cinder block pits back in,
mm-hmm.
and it's in like this Quonset hut design, steel master building type design, with brick pits on one side, double.
Mm-hmm.
So you had 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 pits that doubled on one side that held two hogs apiece.
Oh, wow.
And then for days that we would cook odd numbers of hogs, we had single pits on the other side.
Oh, cool.
So
you guys are cranking.
Oh, yeah. You know, we had a total of 20 pits put into that building.
Is there parts of it you miss?
No.
Everything's just better now for Rodney.
Yeah, it's good that I don't have to go outside to get hot coals.
Right.
In Hemingway, we had to put the barrel outside.
Oh, okay.
And in Charleston, you just walk to the back of the room.
It's right there.
Yeah, it's right there. A lot more convenient.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I don't know if this is a trade secret, but like when you have those hogs, what kind of, say, you know, because there's a lid, so you're essentially, it's smoking. So barbecue is, correct me if I'm wrong, other than, you know, seasoning and stuff like that, it's basically lightly smoking and baking.
Yes.
With a natural wood fire.
Exactly.
Or coals.
Exactly.
From a fire.
Exactly.
So that's it.
Yeah.
So low and slow. If it's something, I'm sure, I don't know if this is a secret, feel free to say, Brad, no way. But what kind of temperature do you like to maintain inside, like an ambient temperature of the oven or the barbecue pit?
I like to sit at a temperature between 220, no hotter than 250. Just kind of keep it going, coasting right there. Because the way that we cook it, with the hog being directly over the hot coals, if it drips and there's a flare-up, it can burn real fast.
Right.
So we keep it low and slow to where you keep that slow drip, where the grease is just like a tss.
Yep. Tss. Just a little hiss.
If it's raining, if it sounds like it's like tss, 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 tss,
too much,
you're way too hot, and you stand a chance of a flare up.
And all that tss, tss, is the fat, right, dripping?
Yeah, that's the
which
fat
essentially
dripping.
Is if you're losing that, it's just gonna dry out the pig.
It's gonna dry it out.
Yeah.
And it drips into that, and it steams the flavor right back up.
All
right. So you got that wood and that fat just steaming right back up into the pig.
Little kind of like a little self steaming basting in a way.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm assuming you were doing this as well down in Hemingway, but I'll never forget the mop.
Yeah.
All right. So we had the hog, you know, splayed out on this barbecue pit, and we had it wrapped in wire or like fencing so that we could flip it, because as it gets tender, you know, the joints start loosening up. I'm assuming.
Yeah.
You know, you learned that the hard way back.
Oh,
in the
you
day.
Do.
Yeah. So we had that mop with, you know, with your signature spice mopping liquid, and I'll never forget this. And we were mopping it, and you know, it was a little dab dab dip dab dab dip. And, because we still have the hot coals underneath, and as some of that is dripping down, all that steam is coming up, and certainly some vinegar in it. If I remember correctly, there's some cayenne in there.
Yes.
And I just, the whole time, it was like, it smelled great. I was excited, but I was going blind. Is that something that you know, it was just burning my eyes for hours. Was that something that you guys just get callous to?
Yeah, you get used to it after about 30 years. You'll be fine.
You start liking the burn.
Yeah, you'll be like, all right, a little stinging going on. It'll be all right.
That's
just don't touch
good.
Your eyes.
Right.
Just don't touch them.
Ever.
Never.
All right, great. Well, Rodney, I got to say, it was a pleasure having you in.
Thanks for having
me. Pleasure chatting with you again.
Always.
I'll have to get back down to Charleston because I had a hell of a time down there. And missing that barbecue, missing that hospitality. Hope you can enjoy our town as much as we enjoyed yours. And
I will.
Thanks for sharing your barbecue world.
Thank you.
All right.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.